Talk given Sunday, 8th July, 1979. In this chapter, In the Heart of Religion, which is entitled The Teachers of the Upanishads, we start off straight away with the statement, Atma and Brahman are names for realized transcendence. And these two names fill the Upanishads. Now, the first misinterpretation to which we would be prone is to think, names for realized transcendence, realized by me. No, it's the other way around. They are names for transcendence when it realizes itself as perfect manhood, perfect manness through you or through me. That is what Atma and Brahman stand for. I don't realize Atma. Atma realizes itself through this vehicle because it has become the pure apparatus and the sufficiently strong apparatus to stand the impact and the functioning of that transcendent, incalculable creative energy. That is what Atma and Brahman mean. And the same applies to all the other words like God and so forth in all the other religions. Now we come to the next statement in the Upanishad, chapter 1, section 4, verse 1. Starts off like so many scriptural writings. In the beginning, the world, as it is called, was Atma alone in man form. Purusha Veda. Purusha, man, Veda, form. Looking around, he saw nothing other than Atma. He said first, I am. Thus arose the name I. Now the words as they stand, the words as they stand are somewhat futile, meaningless. Consider the logical interpretation of such statements. In the beginning, that means straight away you are in the context of time. All this was Atma. But Atma is said to be the infinite, the eternal, the immortal, the blissful, the utterly peaceful, and so on. But then what's the meaning of in the beginning if it is the eternal? It has no meaning at all. You see how easy it is? Immediately your high-powered brained scholar says, yes, that was the beginning. You see? And his mind works in terms of time and finitude and mortality. In the beginning. Now, these words, in the beginning, they occur in the Rig Veda, they occur in the Upanishads, they occur in the other religious scriptures too. First chapter of Genesis starts with a mistranslation of the original Hebrew. When they say in the beginning, Bereshit bara Elohim, in the beginning God, and they say created heaven and earth. That's a mistranslation. Bereshit bara Elohim actually means, and Professor Sholem has shown that quite clearly, he's the greatest living Jewish scholar, old man now. Those words mean out of the unknown origin there emerged Elohim. Elohim, the name represents the interplay, the continuous interaction of the eternal what and the eternal who. And through that interaction, earth and heaven came into being. Again, earth and heaven symbolizing different things with regard to our own innermost consciousness. Nothing to do with the sky which you see upstairs or the earth on which you stand. Well, let's go on. Now, in the beginning, all this was Atma alone in man form. This is most significant. Purusha Veda, in the form of a man. People would say this is pure anthropomorphism. You see? An anthropomorphic deity. Not at all. Consider carefully. Whatever is our innermost realization, or the deepest depth to which we can perceive, is always interpreted by the brain in human terms. Concepts and words are human terms. And when concepts and words are related to that which is ultimate, they are always related to oneself as a human being, because no human being can get away in ultimateness from his own human existence. This is one of the extraordinary facts. If you ever have had real experience of the deep states of consciousness, you will find that you end up with I am. I, in the completely non-egoistic sense, is the realization by Atma of its own eternity through you, the temporal, its own infinitude through you, the finite, its own immortality through you, the mortal. It shows the inescapability of the apparatus, this living being, the apparatus, which raises up the knowledge of self. See, this is one of the very, very, very difficult inner obstacles to realizing true voidness. See, we talk about the void and shunyata and so forth. We all sound so learned and wonderful, you know. Right. So, it is in man form. Now, the word man, Purusha Veda, and the Upanishads, with their quaint, totally unacceptable, that is to say, philologically unacceptable explanation of the meaning of the word Purusha, which means a person. The Buddha says Puriso. He talks about the Uttara Puriso. You see, in the Gita, Sri Krishna is called the Purushottama, the Supreme Purusha, the Supreme Man, and so forth. All right? Now, Purusha, we've done this before, so I'll state it very briefly. split up into the two words, purva, meaning formerly, and ush. The ush part has as its Sanskrit root ush, meaning to burn. And I haven't quoted it here, but the Upanishad goes on to say, because formerly he, referring to the Atma, burnt up all evil-mindedness, sarvam all pap manam. Now scholars, I have noticed in all the translations of the Upanishads, that not one of them has said evil-mindedness. They have all said burnt up all evils, which is nonsense. Consider carefully, formally. Where is there a formally with respect to that which is eternal? If Atma is eternal, there is no formally. And there is no state of sin, papa, at all, present. Don't you see? So, in the beginning represents you yourself in the supreme meditative state. In the translations of the Vedas, sometimes they use the word then instead of in the beginning. And this is purely because of preserving the meter of the verse. In the beginning is four syllables, beginning is five syllables, whereas then is the single syllable. That is why they use either the word then or the phrase in the beginning. It represents you yourself in that state where the perfection of the void plenitude has been passed. You have gone even deeper than that. What the Buddha called the cessation, what in Hindu terminology is called the asampranyata samadhi, you see, and so forth. And yoga, Patanjali's yoga also has this, you see. So in the beginning means that, and purusha means you yourself, formerly, before you entered, were able to enter this state, had burnt up all evil-mindedness. What is the whole of the teaching of the great teachers? Put it in the Buddhist form, cease to do evil, strive to do good, purify the mind. They say mind, they don't say psyche. Have you ever come across any Pali word which is the equivalent of psyche? It's always mind only, isn't it? In translation anyway.
Always mind.
No, that is a pity. That's why I have introduced this distinction between mind and psyche. This universal, utterly pure, archetypal energy. There is nothing to purify there. You see? Interacting with corporeality gives rise to psyche, what we call our mental processes, our feelings and thoughts and so forth, because there is, all those processes are invariably, without exception, associated with electrochemical changes in the body. Can't get away from that. Therefore, this thing which we commonly call our mind is really, it is better to call it psyche, and it is rooted in the physical body. The physical body and the psyche are not separate. The two are actually one indivisible whole. You can't separate them out. They are an indivisible whole, perhaps something like this. You can have pure milk and you can have pure water. If you once mix the two, you can never separate the water from the milk. An extraordinary thing, isn't it? Unlike in most chemical processes, you can evaporate away the water and leave the original substance. You try evaporating mixture of milk and water. See, it's like that. All right. So, Purusha being defined as that which formerly in time, and it is only a man in time, he burnt out all evil mindedness, means utterly purified the psyche, went through the baptism of fire. Burnt out is the phrase used, is the term used, you see. Therefore, he is called Purusha. Now, those people realize the identity of the perfected Holy One with transcendence. They are not two separate things. They are one and the same. I and the Father are one. Pratyagatma and Paramatma are one. Now, if that is the case, then we can begin to understand, looking around, he saw nothing other than Atma. Infinity, immortality, eternity can't look, or hear, or touch. These are all human terms, these are all finite terms, aren't they? So he didn't look around. It's nice for artists to paint wonderful pictures, and they are beautiful, of course, marvelous. The Kabbalists present Yahweh as the primordial man, the ancient one, as the ancient of days. That is the term for him, for this ultimate, the ancient of days. It's a lovely term. All right. So, looking around, he saw nothing other than Atma. But when you are in the supreme meditative state, you can't look around. Because there is no around in that looking. It is a way of suggesting that you are utterly free of any awareness of otherness. The unity of the universe is something of which you are now fully conscious unconsciously. You can function that way. You can function like the transcendent, like God. Not that you, Ron, or me, Firoz, you see, or any particular person can function that way. But that state of consciousness in the supreme samadhi is completely at one with transcendence. And that is why it awakes to omnipotence, omniscience, and omnipresence. Now you see, all that is implied in just these two sentences. Is it easy to study the scripture? Don't study the scripture. Live it. How do you live it? By being quiet and still oneself and letting it speak to you. It will guide your hand. It will guide your sense functioning. And if you are free, utterly free of all vested interest, of all grasping, then like there is a hymn, is there, put your hand in the hand of God, or there is some such statement.
Let the man who stood at the gate of the year give me a light that I may see in the darkness, and he said unto me, put your hand into the hand of God. Yes. That will be better than light and safer than known.
There, that's it. You see now, that's what happens. one can appreciate why a person like Eckhart said, "Man verily is God. God verily is man." It's in that, there are two volumes of Eckhart's writings somewhere here. And in the smaller volume, I think it is on page 104. I can't quite remember. But it is somewhere there. Man verily is God. God verily is man. How true that is. That is about the truest sort of thing which can be uttered by the lips of a human being. So, he said first, "I am." This is the affirmation of being. It is completely, it is a completely unegoistic affirmation. "I am." That is the simple fact. And then only you are truly conscious that you are. You take it for granted. It is something of the nature of course it is so. There's nothing to question about it. Nothing to inquire about. It is the fact. Now, look. When one really sees this, one becomes conscious in that way. And when you do become conscious in that way, what happens to all our reactions of fear, of dislike, of violence, of attachment, of affection? What happens to the whole lot? The psyche just gets purified naturally. Doesn't it? Obviously. I mean, once you are really conscious in this manner, such reactions do not arise from within you. And because they do not arise from within you, you are no longer contributing to the stream of dukkha and upholding the stream of dukkha. And although you are more sensitive than ever and will feel the dukkha of the world far more powerfully, you remain clean and pure, unreactive to it. And it is this which makes you the focus point for the entry and outflow, the nexus, as I've often called it, of transcendence itself, which purifies the whole psychical atmosphere of the world. Now you see, is there one sees at once? What is the need for finding out, now where can I do some good? You look deeply into yourself and see what is it in oneself which makes me look around and see where can I do some good. That subtle egoism, that subtle vanity, the pride, the self-esteem, all those are operating. And Mephistopheles is having a lovely, happy time laughing away merrily at this dear do-gooding fool. When the reality is there, you will inevitably do the good without knowing it. This is the supreme good. Look at the mother or the father who is naturally, just naturally, the real embodiment of motherhood and fatherhood. Good is done by them without their knowing it. People say instinctively. It is not only instinct where the human is concerned. It's much more, much profounder. It is instinct with regard to the animal. Look at all animals. How do they treat their young? Put the bulk of human parents, especially in the modern world, to shame, wouldn't they? There you are. So, the affirmation of being, and this sort of affirmation of being is identical with the complete awareness of being. And this is the supremely blissful state. Awareness being, there's no pleasure in it. There's no sensational delight in it. There is no recognition by the brain that, this is beautiful, this is blissful or interesting. It just is. Now, we can understand why in the Hindu presentation, Brahman, when they try to qualify Brahman, they used the three words Sat, Chit, Ananda. Being, complete awareness or attentiveness, if you like, and bliss. Sat, Chit, Ananda. But you see, we have to be so free of all our petty little concepts and beliefs and so on. When we can be in that state of attentiveness, we are also in the state of constant, ceaseless inquiry. Not inquiry in the sense of searching for something, but this inquiry is of a nature which releases complete understanding. It is related to pure wisdom, to omniscience. And this sort of inquiry is carried out by the mind, we may use the word mind here if you like, is carried out by the mind which is not crushingly conditioned, but is utterly free and open all the time, without allowing itself to be clogged up with conclusions. A conclusion is inevitable because it is associated with the living process of inquiry. But if you don't grasp the conclusion and let it go past, a profounder vision emerges the very next instant, all the time. Now, the mind is maturing, growing in the real living sense. And the psyche is being purified all the time. Because it is the psyche that holds ideas, beliefs, conceptions, and so forth. I've said, now I have gone on, we've just finished that little bit. Now we go on. Man is transcendence thinking. It is because of this in the Upanishads that this particular sentence emerged when I was writing this chapter, when this chapter was getting written. You see how easily we fall into the trap of selfness, separateness. A man is transcendence thinking. This has to be associated with the biblical statement of Genesis. We've talked about it over and over again, chapter 1. And Elohim said, not Yahweh or Yahweh Elohim, the hyphenated. Yahweh is the Lord. Elohim embodied in us the eternal who and the eternal what, in constant active interplay, embodied in the particular living organism, is Yahweh. You see? And when Yahweh Elohim are used together in the Old Testament, it is that is translated as the Lord God. And but in the beginning, in the earlier stage, before man comes on the scene, Elohim said, that is the actual translation as it exists in the language, in the English language, and Elohim said, let us make man in our own image. And the next verse says, male, female, made he them. That is to say, each male body and each female body has both elements in itself, masculine and feminine, in constant interplay. The male body has the female anima. The female body has the male animus, the psychophysical organism, that is, as a whole. You see? But look at that translation. It's a poor translation if one has, if somehow the sense of transcendence has thrilled within one. Transcendence doesn't make things. A making is a putting together, a mechanical synthesizing, not a live integrating. They are very different. The live integrating and the mechanical synthesizing. The primordial creative energy knows nothing about, doesn't just mechanically synthesize. To mechanically synthesize, you must have already separate objects. But this is creative activity, transcending procreative activity. No separate objects at all. See? If that verse is translated this way, and Elohim not said, but minded. Elohim minded. Mind is this archetypal form of the one and only creative energy. And Elohim minded, let us create man in our own living likeness. And you remember I said a little earlier, the word Elohim is compounded of Ele and me, M-I, me, you see, which means the eternal what and the eternal who, in active, timeless interplay. Have a cassette and you sort of play it over and over again. Play it over and over again and get the feel of it. If you once get the feel of it, you see, that is the living, warm part of the psyche gets it, then it is in closer direct touch with that energy which is the sense of transcendence inside you. You also need the other part, because as we are, we will inevitably translate this into concept and word at our stage. We can't avoid that. But if you get the feel of it once, then somehow all that is said will begin to, well, I'll just use the commoner garden phrase, bear fruit inside. It will make God. It will enable consciousness to become more and more intense. This is what happens with samadhi. It's consciousness becoming increasingly intense. Till in the supreme meditative state, consciousness is at its intensest as far as a human being is concerned. We can't go beyond that. So now, let us create man in our own living likeness. Male, female, created he them. Positive, negative. The perpetual interplay of the eternal who and the eternal what. In the phraseology of yoga, akasha and prana, in perpetual creative interplay. So, it is this which releases man. And the man which is released in terms of the, in the transcendent context is the one that is called in the Kabbalah the Ancient of Days, you see, and which in terms of the science of the zodiac, I'm not going to use the word astrology, in terms of the science of the zodiac is the primordial man who encircles the entire globe, our planet, starting with Aries right around to Pisces. That is the original man. Now, what does all that mean in more sort of practical terms we can understand? This is creative energy manifesting itself in so many different ways, its archetypal forms, which in integration lead to all the living creations that there are on this planet. But since a man in the supreme meditative state realizes this, he regards it all in terms of the primordial man form. It's wonderful, you know, when you begin to sort of penetrate into these things. And the esoteric teaching as such definitely states that man is the root source of the entire evolutionary process where the living world on this planet is concerned. This is quite contrary to the ordinary scientific statement. At first it seems contrary. But you see, science is perfectly correct because its context is the context of the finite, of the finite forms, which are the ultimate concrete manifestations of these energies which function in terms of infinity, eternity, immortality. So when it concretizes, it is the animals and so forth which come first, and then we finally come out of the chattering apes, and look how we chatter. Now, supposing you sort of take a mirror image in the context of transcendence, the primordial creative energy, its archetypal forms, you see, and then that is, we won't say which is real and which is unreal, they are both real if you like, you see, and then the image goes the other way around, doesn't it? So it looks as if this primordial creative energy, once it starts this process of proliferation and differentiation, goes the other way around in manifestation. The other is the unmanifest. So that is the original man form. And with the operation of all those energies, and what sort of operation is it? I mean, just consider it even physically. Gravitational energy throughout the constellations, the stars, the planets and so forth, and every bit of matter that we know, the gravitational energy, light energy, heat energy, chemical energy, ordinary mechanical energy, so many different forms of energies which deal with concrete manifestation. We don't know anything yet, or rather science is just beginning to sort of appreciate that there are these mysterious, subtle forms of energy other than the forms of energy that we have understood and come to use and so forth. All right? So, man is transcendence thinking, and Elohim created man in his own living likeness. I'm afraid we'll have to stop there today.